Hey there, folks. We're kicking off today's episode with a cup of tea from the Nepal Tea Collective. Nepal Tea is a social enterprise based in New York that distributes the freshest organically grown teas to different parts of the world directly from smallholder farmers in the beautiful country of, you guessed it, Nepal. You can join us for a cup of tea and be part of the global impact they're creating by visiting nepalteacollective.com. That's nepalteacollective.com. Yikes, my cup of tea is already getting cold. So why don't you join me and hop into today's episode?
While at the helm of a fast-growing and thriving Pan-African healthcare company, failure was a far-fetched concept to Stephen Ajay, until it wasn't. After scaling into unknown territories and encountering multiple crippling setbacks, years of work and hard-earned capital went down the drain. In this episode, we sat down with Stephen to unpack the realities of scaling profitable businesses in Africa, his renewed relationship with failure, and the incredible multi-million dollar comeback he was able to pull off. Stephen is also the best-selling author of Pay the Price, an award-winning book that outlines the tools that entrepreneurs need to adopt in order to deal with the gravity of their dreams and the realities of tragic setbacks in our journeys. Join us in the boardroom to learn how to leverage failure and pain in order to build resilience and an unshakable vision for your future.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whoever you are, wherever you are. Welcome to the Boardroom Banter podcast. My name is Sean Karanja. You're joining myself and Mr. Boniface Omina in the boardroom. It's a lovely day. It's a cool day out here in Nairobi, but we're happy to host you. Boniface, how's everything going?
Besides this weather in this city, everything is going really well, Sean. It's awesome to be back onto the podcast with you.
Sir.
And definitely bringing people a brand new guest and a brand new story for them to sink their teeth in.
Man, let me tell you, the guest that we have today, I think his life should be made into a movie. Like, I'd watch that movie.
I would.
someone needs to sit down and figure out, how do we get Stephen on a movie? Well, we won't keep our audience in too much suspense. In the boardroom today, we've got none other than Mr. Stephen Ajay, who is the founding partner of Blue Cloud Health, an Africa-focused but UK-based healthcare consultancy firm, and the Emerald Group, which is a multi-sectoral consultancy based in Dubai and New Delhi. And really importantly, and something that I think Boniface should be excited about, you know, Boniface had mentioned he was starting a book. If you guys have been loyal listeners of this podcast, you'd remember that Founders Friday where Boniface said he has one chapter. Is it one chapter?
I have one chapter done. Don't hold me accountable until I mention it again.
Come on, you can do this.
So
drawing inspiration from you, Stephen.
Stephen has written a book, which actually two books, which are number one international bestsellers. The first, and which I think is super important and exciting, which you shall dig into, is called Pay the Price. And coming out in August 20, actually, it's already come out. His second book is called In Search of Performance. And we'll be digging into really what his journey has been like. But, you know, fundamentally, Stephen is, as we speak, on a journey to mentor African entrepreneurs, young professionals, etc. Anyone who's really trying to build, because fundamentally he's an African optimist. You know, he's a poet as much as he's a pharmacist and healthcare consultant, as much as he's got his MBA from Warwick Business School. He's got all that happening, but definitely it has not been an easy journey getting to where he has gotten to. And fundamental to some of the concepts in his book, Pay the Price, is that you only get to where you need to get to by paying a certain price. And he lays out a really fantastic framework for us to understand what that is, to take out the fear that we might have about some of the sacrifices, some of the pain that may come along in that journey, and making it as fun and memorable as possible. Stephen, welcome so much to the boardroom. We're really excited to have you here. How's everything going?
Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, the UK is quite hot for a change.
For a change.
So, I've been in my office today and I've been sunbathing and enjoying the lovely weather because, you know, things could change very quickly in the UK. Tomorrow could be a thunderstorm.
Oh, man.
So I've had a really good day enjoying the sun, and I'm really grateful to be your guests.
That's fantastic, Stephen. Tell us a bit more about yourself. Describe to us some of your life's work experiences. Who is Stephen?
That's a good question. So, recently, I went through a coaching course with a coach. And the coach, after two or three days, he said, "Stephen, I'm going to describe you." He said, "You're an empathy-led professional." I have no idea what that means. But he said, "I'm an empathy-led professional." So I think I'll start with that. I'm an empathy-led professional. I was born in the UK in the 70s. And then I came to live down with Ghana with my parents. So I had my education in Ghana. I went to the same school as your previous guest, Yao Nsako. And then went to university as well in Ghana and qualified as a pharmacist. Won an award. And then came to the UK, and then continued to practice as a pharmacist. But after 4 years, I began to get the itch, you know, the kind of purpose calling thing that my life was worth more than just pharmacy. Not saying that pharmacy is a bad thing, but there was definitely a tug, a calling on me to do something more, and I had no idea. So what came to me was to go to do an MBA in business. So I went to the best school, one of the best schools in the UK. I came out with a good MBA. And after that, I decided to form my own company called Blue Cloud Health. So initially, when we started Blue Cloud, the idea was to incubate African companies and then present them to investors. So that happened for the first 3 or 4 years. We traveled around the world, one Africa. We were in Nairobi, we were in Cape Town, Luanda, Lagos, Ghana, all over the place, looking for good companies and good entrepreneurs. And we held our first conference in Cape Town and the second conference actually in Nairobi, 2017. So yeah, things went well for the first 4 years. I was living the dream, and then the inevitable crash happened.
Cliffhanger. You just left us in suspense.
Yes.
Us and the listeners are holding on to this story on a thread, Stephen. But that's an amazing way to break the ice into this conversation. And we love speaking to our guests about some of the early childhood experiences. I was listening to an interview yesterday on Radio 254. It's a Kenyan radio station that plays 24 hours Kenyan music. And they were interviewing one of my friends. He's a Kenyan artist. His name is Razorman. And he was speaking about how he grew up in Mombasa, right? And the environment, his family set up, his father had been a big inspiration for him getting into music. His grandfather had led one of the genres that really came up in Mombasa during the time. And what I really picked from that conversation, and we loved relating it here in the podcast, is how the different people, environments, and spaces in which we were at in our childhood really influenced not just who we are today, but the work that we do. I'd love to hear a bit about this from you, Stephen. For us to understand who you are today and the work that you do, are there some environments, spaces, and people in your early childhood life who really played an instrumental role in shaping that trajectory for you?
Absolutely. And looking back at it now, I mean, my dad, he's still alive now. He's one of the best dads anybody could hope for. Brilliant man. Very kind, but also very hardworking, also an entrepreneur. And he introduced me to books when I was very, very young. And he's a lawyer now, so he introduced me to books. So I loved reading. And my mom was also an entrepreneur. You know, Africa, most women are entrepreneurs, you know. So my mom was also an entrepreneur, owned a shop, and she used to sell fish and stuff. But I think what shaped me most is that where we lived, I had quite a privileged childhood. So we lived in a very nice house. But just across the house from me was a lot of poverty and a huge slum. So I learned very quickly how to combine my privileged background with my reality of poverty around me, you know, and that has served me really well. So I was able to hold these two contrasts in my mind very well, contrast of poverty and also of a wealthy upbringing. So looking back at it now, I only thought about it the other day, that my whole life has been that. I've always been between two things, you know, either between black and white, between the science and between the arts, between business and between music. So my life has always been a tapestry, should I say, of two contrasting, seemingly contrasting things. And that came from my childhood, you know, and I've also learned to how to relate to people that are rich, I mean, and very, very wealthy, and also relate to people that are very, very poor and are homeless. And I can relate to people on the same level. And that again comes from my childhood of living in a privileged background, but very close to poverty. So I think for me, that's the main thing that I took away from my childhood.
Awesome. You have a really big love and dedication to Africa as a continent. And I mean, that's been evident in even the, you know, brief conversations that we've had before we hopped onto here. Why did you pick healthcare and why do it in Africa? And maybe you could also talk about the journey of expanding that infrastructure across the continent. And then you can start to give us a bit of a picture of what went well, what went wrong, because there's lots of people who think, hey, just because there's a big, scary problem, it means that, you know, if you go in there with a good solution, it has to stick.
Yeah. You're right.
Walk us through that.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, in Africa, your parents give you three choices. Okay. And my dad gave me three choices: medicine, engineering, or law. I mean, we're all familiar with this, with these three things. And I told my dad, I'm not going to do medicine. So that's out of the question. So we settled on pharmacy, which was a good mix. Again, two contrasting, science and business. So that worked for me. So it seemed normal and sensible for me to go into healthcare after my MBA and go to Africa, because I trained as a healthcare professional all my life. I trained as a healthcare professional in the UK and I had a business sense of it. But I've realized over the last year or two that my remit has begun to branch out of healthcare. So we're now dealing with companies, with energy. And the other day we're dealing with a company that makes cars. So even though I've become healthcare based, the MBA, my reading and my writing has helped me now to transcend healthcare into other fields. Having said that, we chose healthcare because in Africa, we thought, and then when we started around 2012, 2013, Africa was then becoming more democratic. There was talk of the new Africa, you know, the books coming out on Africa. There were lots of entrepreneurs, businesses were being built. So Africa seemed, there was hope. There was a big hope. I mean, I'm not sure they've seen the Economist title. It said Africa, the hopeful continent. 4 years ago, it was called the hopeless continent. So there was a lot of optimism in those days when I started Blue Cloud. Investors were ready to commit money to the continent. African entrepreneurs were rising up. So it was a good combination in those days, which is like 10 years ago. And things took on really well. People were eager. But we decided to focus on Middle Africa because we, according from our research, that's where the growth really was. You know, the upper echelons, you know, the 5 million plus deals had already been accounted for. And the 300,000, 400,000 deals below were also being accounted for by charity and stuff, NGOs. So there was the missing middle, as we called it, you know, between 500,000 and 5 million, that tranche there, were really struggling for funding. And it was because they were not quite startups, but they were also not quite finished products, you know, so there was a lot of work involved. And when you speak to investors, they used to say, "Oh, if we go for a middle class, it's difficult because you have to be a hand holding, and you don't get much return." So we decided to go for that middle area. It was good the first 3 months. We got some good companies in Ghana, Equity Pharmacy. We got some good companies in Angola. We got some good companies in Kenya, as well, Botswana. So it was really good. investors were eager. But there was a big problem. The big problem was investors wanted to come in and just put the money in and go back. Okay. They didn't want that incubator stage thing. They didn't want to do that. And the capital that was needed was around 1 million, 2 million. And most investors were either too big. You know, I talk about this when we get to pain, you know, the fact that there was a mismatch between the markets that we wanted to do and what was available. So the first 3 years, where there's a lot of activity, we made some bit of money. But after the fourth, fifth year, that began to become evidence that there was a mismatch, you know. So there was efforts on our side to bring up the companies to that level. But then sometimes there's a mindset shift, you know. When we're a $300,000 company, $1 million company, and you want to step into the $4-5 million, there's a mindset shift. You know, you have to move from being a father, a patriarch, a matriarch, to being a CEO. And a lot of the companies couldn't make that shift, you know, because it means that they had to let go of control. You know, in Africa, how we're like, you know, they want to control everything, make sure people come on time. But once you begin to go past a certain level, you have to begin to relinquish control, begin to think of equity investing. And most middle class, middle Africa, they wanted to maintain 100% control of the company. They wanted to be the ones in charge. But once you begin to get to that point, that's the beginning. So there were problems in that area, infrastructure problems. And what really crippled us after the fourth year was corruption, really. So in both ways, we got a bit too eager. So we should have stayed with the safe markets, Ghana, Nigeria, well, Ghana, Kenya, Botswana, Namibia. Those were safe markets, okay? But we ventured into Angola. You know, we thought, oh, we can do this, you know? We went to Angola, and that's where we got bitten really, really hard. You know, we lost a lot of money because we signed a deal for a $60 million Center for Diagnostics in Luanda. And then we got duped really badly. We lost tens and tens of thousands of pounds. I nearly went bankrupt. And then I lost, around the same time, I lost my sister. Well, that came a bit later, suddenly. And then due to the stress of it all, I developed epilepsy. And I had two fits, one of which I was driving. I had a brand new car, which I bought when we started the business. I crashed it, ended up in A&E, in the hospital, and then got diagnosed with epilepsy. We had to close up. We had an office in Johannesburg. We had to close it down. And then due to the pressure, I made some bad moral decisions, went into pornography, nearly lost my marriage. So things went really, really low and really, really bad. So I had to give up Blue Cloud for a long time and just focus on the 9-to-5, because I got into so much debt. Because what happened was we had an office built in Dubai, which we still have now, by the way. We had an office in Dubai. We had to close the office down for a while. And it was just a mess. So things went really, really bad. But still, I still had that desire, that thing in me to continue what I was doing, you know. And I will come back to that, I suppose, when we talk about the honeymoon period, you know. So I had that desire in me to continue. And yeah, so it took 10 years. It took 10 long years of hard labor, struggling, dealing with bankruptcy, dealing with family issues, marriage issues. You had to go to a coach with the pornography. It took a long time. But after the 10th year, I said to you, my sister died suddenly. So we had to fly back to Ghana. It was a struggle to afford the money for a ticket, even. It was really bad. So I got to Ghana, buried my sister. And just before I was about to leave, we had a breakthrough. And then we signed a $1 million deal just as I was about to leave Ghana and come back to the UK. So that's what happened. That's a brief, or not so brief, reports of what happened.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Stephen. Thank you for the vulnerability. I think one of the important things I'm hearing, and hope the listeners are catching on to this, when we bring guests to the boardroom and we have these conversations about success, about, you know, building companies, about building careers, some people often miss the lows, right? The times when things weren't going right, the times when, you know, we almost give up on what we're trying to do or on what we're chasing. And it's something that I've been confronting a lot lately, right? Yeah. Looking at the work that I do with the podcast, the work that I do in events. And this fear is a fear of losing everything, right? Our personal, the works of our hands, our crafts, you know, our gifts, the places where we find solace, the places where we find inspiration. And in one of your recent LinkedIn posts, you wrote something very beautiful. You said, believe in your honeymoon period, right? And the context of this post was around pain, about the fact that, you know, it'll hurt before success. And I'm very curious, Stephen, over the course of all of these events happening, what were some of the emotions that you were going through? Who were you turning to with these emotions? What were some of your support systems? And talk to us a bit about how you navigated pain during this period of time, tying it back to the four pain flags.
Yeah, so that's a good question, a very good question. And the issue of pain is real. I mean, you mentioned this, and most books that you read, I mean, I went to my MBA, and most people did this. There was not a single mention of failure or pain or struggle. It seemed like a formula. You have your business plan, you go there, you put that together, and that comes out at the end. You know, so most of us came out of university after MBA all starry-eyed, thinking, oh, the life is going to be good, everything's going to be. But obviously, when that didn't happen, I think there's a first phase of disappointments and anger, you know, angry at, obviously, sometimes you get people get angry at Africa, get angry with the leaders, with the systems, angry at yourself because you feel that you're naive. So the first thing was anger and disappointment that I faced, you know. Disappointment because my wife kept warning me, Stephen, stick with the pharmacy, do your 9-to-5, get a guaranteed income. And I didn't listen to her. I said, no. I have a bigger calling, you know. And she said to me, see, I told you, you put yourself right. You should have listened to me, all that stuff, you know. A lot of my friends also that I thought were friends also turned their backs on me. Obviously, they were in for the glory. So once that happened, a lot of friends turned their back on me. I had only about 3 or 4 people that really stood by me then. Most of the people just began to turn their backs or stuff. But I had a faith, you know, I had a faith, and that faith really sustained me. And also, I talk about the honeymoon period. Okay, so before I launched Blue Cloud, I took an inventory of what I wanted, you know. And I knew that I loved Africa. Okay, I knew that Africa needed help, and Africa was going through a new phase. I knew that was my purpose, something I knew deep down. I have a love and passion for Africa, and I'm an entrepreneur by nature. Okay, I've never been able to work very long in a corporate environment. I will either get fired or I get into a row with the boss. So I'm not really a good. I'm a good. So those three things together were my honeymoon period. Okay, I knew who I was as a person. And I think I talk about 5 things: being a good steward, having a good identity, having a strong purpose, having the trail. Now the trail is a mixture of your competence and your compassion. So competence means that you know what you're doing. Okay, and I knew what I was doing at an MBA. I was a good pharmacist. I had an award, so I knew that. I knew my stuff. And the compassion bit is being kind to people. I knew I had that. And then stickability, I had a resilience. So those 5 things were there. So because the foundations were strong, you know, I built my business on that foundation in me. That was strong, you know, and so that kept me through 10 years, really. And this is not different in life. You know, when you get married, you know, you go to, people go to all over, they travel to Barbados, they travel to Mauritius. I mean, if you're Kenya, you probably go somewhere nice in Kenya to go in and chill for the next 2 weeks. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason why people, when they get married, they travel and enjoy themselves for 2 weeks. We call that a honeymoon, because that is when they get to know each other, they begin to love each other. When we are at the brink of divorce, through all these problems and all the stuff that I did wrong, we had to go through counseling, major counseling. The first thing the counselor asked me was, do you remember when you got married and how you felt? And that question saved our marriage. That question saved our marriage, you know, because we looked back and remembered, yes, we got married at this time. Remember, we were reminiscing about how the love we had for each other, how we felt, all that. That was the honeymoon. And that is what saved the marriage, that question, you know, because we'd forgotten over the time of stress and pain and problems, we'd forgotten that actually, we love each other, and that's why we're getting married. the same with the business. When that happened, that honeymoon was so strong that we couldn't fail. I mean, we could not fail. And it's the same for everything. When David became king, God used to remind him, you know, remember when I took you out of from your, that was the honey, God was reminding him of his honeymoon period. When the Israelites were going through stress, God reminded them, you remember when I took you to the Red Sea and opened the, that's God reminded them of the honeymoon period. So all of us need to have a honeymoon period where we enjoy the life of starting everything fresh. If you don't enjoy that and you don't really sink into your soul, you will fail. That's the basis of the book.
So when we think of pain and some of the things that you've written about, you know, beyond the three phases of entrepreneurship. So you've just talked about the honeymoon phase, then there's the formative phase, then legacy phase. Failure tends to happen in that second part, the formative part of things, where now you are actually learning that, wow, okay, I had these great ideals and ideas. Things don't always go according to plan. And when they don't, your framework of understanding this pain, the four pain flags, I found was a very interesting way of just taking a toll of how everything is going. Because just like Boniface had briefly mentioned, you know, you were probably facing a lot of, I mean, anxiety, fear, like there's lots of emotions that were happening. How have you now, you know, now that you're out of it and now that you've dealt with it, how do you now structure those types of pain? So you've got four flags, which you'll expound on: the red flag, amber flag, green flag, and white flag. Walk us through those things, because there might be someone listening to this who is in immense pain and is just like going through the most. But there's a way to deal with these and actually understand, hey, putting a name to things. Walk us through those four.
Okay, so basically every entrepreneur and every business person will go through four kinds of pain. I mean, and these pains are actually quite pronounced more in Africa than is, believe it or not. So let's start from the red flag pain. So red flag pain is what I call the pain of self-sabotage. Okay, so it's the things that we do to ourselves that makes our pain, makes our journey longer, makes our pain worse, makes things worse for us. Okay. It's called a red flag pain because when you're driving and you get to a red flag, you need to stop. Okay. You cannot, if you drive to the red flag, you will likely crash your car, kill yourself, and cause a lot of damage. Okay. So red flag pain is, and I mentioned my case about the case of pornography. So for me, the red flag was pornography. Okay. So we tend to self-sabotage when we're going through pain. Okay. Or when things don't happen the way we want. Okay. Or we have unhealthy habits that we go to when things are not doing so well, when things are doing really, really well. Some of my red flag pain happened when we were on the brink of breakthrough. You know, and I remember in Nigeria one day where we were just about to sign a deal in Lagos. We went to this penthouse apartments, had a lovely time. It was English people, Nigerians, Kenyans. It was a lovely day at this penthouse. And when I came back to the hotel, I had such a high sense of high that I end up going back to red flag pain. You know, sometimes it's not just the lows, it's also the highs that you need to be careful about, you know. So when you are very low, you can go into red flag pain, which is self-sabotage. Also, when you are very high, you can also go into red flag pain. And this is for people like who have like alcoholism, gambling, you know, those big things that we all know about. You know, they come either when you're very low or when you're very high, you can go into red flag pain. And that will self-sabotage you. For me, when I entered into pornography, the next day I felt really bad. I felt worthless, you know, because the thing about pornography and actually about most kinds of things that we do is that you need a bigger and bigger hits to get a bigger response. And it's like weed, drinking, everything, you know. So I found myself going deeper and deeper and deeper. I mean, and I know friends that drank. I've got a friend now that's actually in rehab, lost his lost her husband, lost her children. She's not in rehab because she needed more drink to get that hits, you know. And so if you don't stop the red flag pain at a point very quickly, you will crash your car, you will crash your business, you will crash your life, and everything that you have will be gone, you know. And I go through the book of six ways where you can deal with the red flag pain, but that would be too long, so I won't go through that. But there are ways where you can go through that. Last one is AMBA. So AMBA fat pain is the pain of waiting. Okay. So when you are driving and you get to AMBA, you need to wait. Okay. It means that you are just about to go, but it's a waiting time. Now I use AMBA, but in the traffic lights, there's a few seconds and you're going, but actually in life, it could be very, very long. You know, the average waiting time for success for an entrepreneur is 10 years, believe it or not. Well, that's the average waiting time. Okay. Some people get it easier, 2-3 years. Some people 2 weeks and they're gone. Some people have to wait for, and the average waiting time is 10 years.
Man, that's like half of my life. That's crazy.
I mean, this is called quick success. You know,
I don't want to wait.
This for major success. Okay. Obviously, if you want to, all these big guys that we read about, Virgin and all these guys, they have to wait for it. So they obviously, right, they wait till you are sitting still and things don't happen. But the real breakthrough, the real when people begin to know you and you begin to hear about you and stuff, it's roughly about 10 years. Even for sportsmen, I mean, last year an Englishman won the Wimbledon for the first time. It was 2 years ago. Can't remember again. She was only 19 or 20 when she won it, but actually she'd been practicing tennis since she was 10. You know. People say, oh, look at her, she's so young, 20 years old, she won. But actually, her father put on tennis coaching when she was 10. So it was 10 years before she won the first thing, even though she's only 20. Do you understand? So there is a waiting period, and many entrepreneurs fail because they cannot wait. You know? So again, it comes down to your honeymoon period. If you know your honeymoon period is strong, you know that you've gone through all the processes, you have a strong person, strong passion, strong purpose, then you can wait. And if you wait, you're likely to succeed, obviously. And now, at the end of the waiting period, it doesn't mean that the dream you started with the same dream that you ended with, okay? It's just like a traffic light in Nairobi. When you get to green, sometimes there's an arrow pointing this way and an arrow pointing that way, okay? So you might be going straight, but there's an arrow going that way. So you actually can go right, and that's pivoting. You know, so you can actually wait. And after 10 years, you realize that actually, this is not what I was meant to be doing. It's actually there. So you can pivot, but you still have to wait, you know? And then the third one, which is green flag pain, is the pain that you hear when people say things to you. Okay. So for me, everybody around me said I would fail. Okay. My wife was supportive, but including my wife, she was, so my friends, my coaches, my schoolmates, everybody said, look, what are you doing in Africa? Africa is a horrendous place to work. It's never going to work, especially into the third, fourth, fifth year. The voices began to get louder. My voice in my own head began to get louder. You know, everything around me was saying this thing was going to fail, okay? But green flag pain means that despite the fact that you hear all these phases, you keep going, okay? Because when you're driving and you get to a green flag, you keep going. If you stop at a green flag, you will crash your car again, you know? So when you hear all these voices, all these things in your head, people telling you all this stuff, it's a green flag. You need to keep going. Many people get discouraged at the green flag pain. They get discouraged because people are telling them this is not going to work. It's bad. It's a bad idea. You're not qualified. And then they give up. So to succeed, you need to navigate this green flag and move forward. The last pain that we go through is what I call white flag pain. And I actually got this idea from a restaurant in Botswana, which is, it was in Kenya. You know, it was in Nairobi. And I'll tell you, there's this restaurant in Nairobi. It's a wonderful restaurant. Okay. And I was there with my friends. And they serve meats. That's what they do, meats. I don't know what I can't remember what it's
Fugo.
Called.
Fugo Gaucho. Yeah,
that's it.
There we go. That's a beautiful restaurant.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. So we were there.
I can see you're a man of taste, Stephen.
Oh, yeah, but I love it, man. I loved it. So actually, it was Nairobi, but I got that idea. So you enter to this restaurant, you have a seat, and then they start bringing you meats. Okay, so this guy, they have meats on the skewers, and these guys were just bringing us the meats. And then I was just going for it. I mean, we had all sorts of meats. Some of the meats I can't even mention here, but there was all sorts, you know. And we were just eating the meats. And then when you are full, you put a white flag on your plates. And that white flag means that you surrender. Okay, boss, I can't have any more. And then but if you don't put the white flag there, they'll keep bringing you the meats, you know. So the white flag is a flag of surrender. You know, you get to a point where, okay, I'm black, I'm African, I'm going to face racism. That's surrender. Some people try to become white. You can't do that. Okay. For me, apart from the fact that I'm black and I'm an African, I suffer from epilepsy. Okay. The reason why I put out that post that you read this morning is because last night I had a massive fit, you know, massive fit. I end up on the floor, had to be carried, you know, just 2 days ago.
Sorry.
A massive fit, you know. But it gets to a point where after 10 years, I've been having these fits. I've gone to hospital. I've taken medication. I've done everything I can. And they're still there. It's better now. I get them not often now, but it's there. I had a choice. I either surrender to the fact that I've got epilepsy and use it for my good, or I complain and moan and cry and give up and say, oh, and that's what some people call learned helplessness. You know, you learn to become helpless. Oh, I've got epilepsy. Oh, I'm black. Oh, I'm African. Oh, I'm a woman. And then they use that to become, to learn to be helpless. You know, for me, I look back at the epilepsy as a blessing, because without the epilepsy, I would not be writing, I wouldn't have written a book. That book came about because I had a fit. I fell down the stairs, broke my back. And I said to myself, if I don't write this book, I could be dead. You know, so that epilepsy is the catalyst that's made me an international best-selling author. And that epilepsy is what's making me sit down before you guys now, you handsome guys now, and giving you this story. You know, so sometimes these things that we think are curses, it depends on your perspective. Okay, it took a long time for me to accept, and I still believe that one day I'll be cured of it or things will get well, but I'll be able to use that white flag pain. I've surrendered to it. I can't drive anymore because, you know, I can't drive because I'm epileptic. So everywhere I go, I have to either walk, but through that, I cycle everywhere. Okay, through that, I walk a lot. That's kept me fit. I mean, I did my heart rate, and it's 52. You know, that for a man of my age, the normal rates are on 60, 65, 70. Mine is 53, 52. Because I can't drive, I've been forced to walk. I've been forced to run. I've been forced to cycle. And that's kept me fit.
Is 52 a good?
I mean, yeah. From 60 upwards is brilliant. Your respiratory rates, okay? That's how hard your heart has to beat for you to live. If your heart is beating at a low rate, it means that you are fit. Your heart is not struggling. The higher you go, the more unfit you are. So some people's heart rate is 100. You're likely to get a stroke. It means your heart has to beat 100 times a minute to pump blood through your body. My heart has to beat just 52 times a minute to pump blood through my body. So my heart is very strong. And that is because, not because I like running or exercising or like going to the gym. It's because I've been forced to do that because of my white flag pain. Does it make sense? Yeah.
I think that's incredible because what you're showing us is how pain can actually be a catalyst towards propelling us towards our dreams. Absolutely. And I like this framework that is emerging. And I think the way it's settling in my mind is, you know, that honeymoon phase, and you keep mentioning how important it is because, you know, when I think of how I, you know, and we've spoken before on this podcast, you know, I also had like a pretty traumatic, you know, experience with failure.
You too remember that. That was horrible.
You know, when I hear your story, I'm just like, dude, I have nothing to complain about in this life.
Oh, it's what's near to you, isn't it? What's near, I mean, some people have got it bad, worse than I have. It's what's near to you. It's what's happened to you. You
know? Definitely. And you know, for me, this was something that, you know, I had multiple years of, you know, being really convinced that entrepreneurship was for me. I had all these great ideas. You know, I had successes under my belt, and, you know, it felt like things were just leading up naturally to this thing. And so for those who haven't listened to our previous podcast, at some point during COVID, I was running an investment fund, trading and, you know, stocks, crypto, etc. It was a skill I'd been developing for most of my time in university. So it was one of those things of, I'm a broke uni student, how can I make money? I got so good at it that, you know, I started running a fund because now your friends, family, they're like, hey, this guy, there's something you've figured out here, we want to be a part of. And, you know, it's that thing of, again, people like to be in your corner when things are going pretty well. And so when everything crashed and burned, one particular business partner of mine, I mean, just decided to make life absolute hell. You know, it was like, first of all, my life is already hell. Like, I've lost everything. Everything I was building for like 3 years, lost in 2 weeks. Like, you know that? I couldn't compute.
I've just clocked what you're talking about. I remembered.
Yeah. You know, and this time I was in school. You know, so I'm trying to finish my education and I'm trying to do other things. I just started the podcast also. Man, let me tell you, you know, the depression that comes from those different flags is so crazy. And I think for me, when this happened, green flag pain and red flag were two of the hardest to get out of. Red flag pain, that one of self-sabotage. I mean, I was just like drinking excessively, you know, just in this state of like avoidance of the fact that this thing happened. And, you know, luckily, because I had other things going for me, it was a really internal battle where it's like, as far as everyone else around me is concerned, I simply pivoted. But, you know, very few people, even to this day, actually know like the whole extent of this thing. But, you know, I found myself distracting myself and self-sabotaging, you know. And it looks like you're living a normal uni student life. You know, you're partying with everyone else. You're doing like all the other things. But deep down, you know that this is you self-sabotaging, you know. And these were habits that I picked up when I was, you know, basically a millionaire, you know, early 20s. You can go wherever you want, buy whatever you want, do whatever, you know. So like, there was a recklessness of lifestyle. And that got worse when now I had nothing, you know. And then green flag pain, which is the voices that now you're hearing of, you know, a business partner who you guys confided in each other, you like everything was going well, things go south, you know, like now there's, you know, accusations, there's this, there's that. Then what I learned about green flag and red flag pain is that they're so bad because they're things that you internalize. So green flag being the voices of others, because the voices of others become your own voice now. Now you start to believe that internally. Red flag pain, you know that you're self-sabotaging. You know that, you know, you're sleeping all day, you're procrastinating, you're drinking, doing drugs, whatever. Like, you know what you're doing to yourself. I think that's the worst pain, the one that's self-inflicted. It sucks. It's the worst. And I think just like you, I also found that the only thing that turned me around was good habits and my faith. Because, I mean, fundamentally, I mean, I'm a Christian, born, raised, and it was one of those things of like, I was a Christian in private, you know, like really strong relationship with God and whatever, but it was conflicting with this lifestyle I wanted to live, friends that were around me, you know, I didn't want to be that weird guy, talk about like, oh, this is what I believe in. But when you have nothing left and now it's just like, man, it's just me and God, you know, and me and this body, what can I do? So I started going to the gym. It's, you know, building that confidence piece by piece. But, you know, my honeymoon stage, you know, the startup incubators I went for, the like workshops I went and traveled, like the life before this crash, that's all that kept me by the way, because I just knew all of this couldn't have happened if I'm not actually meant to be on that trajectory.
100%.
And yeah, like later now, you know, you're stronger, you're better, but it now becomes very obvious. And I guess that's why now you want to go into mentorship and you've written books. Now it becomes super obvious to me when someone else is going through that kind of pain, whatever it is that's caused it, there's very telltale. And, you know, it's very interesting that you put together these flags, because someone might look like they're okay, but you know, as a seasoned, pained person, it's like I know the symptoms.
That's why empathy led.
I tell you,
seasoned, pained professional.
I tell you. So it's interesting because now, and the question now I want, where I want to lead this into, right now, a big conversation is now, I've long pivoted, figured things out. Things are way better than they were, even in the bestest of times when things, you know, things are worked out now. But there's now the question of now these stages of life. Okay, now I know I'm no longer in honeymoon. Now it's formative stage. How do you now go about making sure that you don't go back into that?
That's the thing.
You, I mean, you've just mentioned, and we're really sorry about it, but I mean, you still have some of these lingering, you know, you've still got epilepsy, which is a symptom of what happened to you. I mean, your trauma was so deep, it manifested physically. So you've still got these lingering pieces. What do you put in place to make sure you're not going backwards? What do you put in place? I know that your faith has also been an important thing. What are you putting in place to make sure it doesn't happen again? You got $1 million deal. You're going back into business. I mean, are you not terrified? And what are you doing about that?
Yeah. I mean, they're really, that's a really good question. But I put through six things that I've done, which I wrote about in the book. The first thing is that you should accept that you have problems. Okay, and that's the first stage that a lot of us don't do. Okay, so for me, it took me a long time to accept the fact that I was self-sabotaging doing pornography. I told myself, oh yeah, I can do this. So I won't do it again tomorrow. It's just a one-off. But the key thing is acceptance. And many of us don't go past that phase, you know. And acceptance means that, okay, right, I have a problem now. What do I do with the problem? Okay, the second thing is this problem needs to come out into the open. If you're really, really serious about dealing with the problem, that problem needs to come out into the open. It doesn't mean you should go around with a drum in the streets of Nairobi saying that, oh yes, I'm a pornographic addict. No. Or look at me, I like drinking. No. But there should be a few people around you who should be aware of this thing. Okay. And sometimes for me, I had to go for professional help. Okay. And that meant that I saw this guy. I had to put some stuff on my phone. I still have it now. It's called Covenant Eyes. So I had to pay and download it on my phone. And that phone, I have five people that I trust. Okay, so my pastor is one of them. My younger brother, who looks up to me. You know, I've got three friends. So the thought of, if I went back into pornography, the thought that my younger brother would see that on his phone, say, oh, my big brother's back into pornography again. That thought alone was enough to scare me from doing it again. You know, and I tell things about our accountability partners. Okay, so I have three or four people that I'm meeting actually after this call, after this podcast. I'm meeting them today. We have a talk. He's from Rwanda. Another guy's English, all entrepreneurs, and we have a meeting once a week. We go for a walk, and we keen with ourselves. What's happening with you? What's going on? You know, they are my accountability partners. If I mess up, they are there to support me. Okay. And the fifth thing is that there must be a support system in place for you, which is non-judgmental. Okay. So have people around you so accountability partners are good, but you have people around you, okay, that love you and support you for whoever you are and who speak positive things into your life. I have a friend called Kate Wright, who is English, who does that for me. She's always speaking positive things to my life. Stephen, I pray for you today. How are things going on with you? I believe in you. I trust you. That gives you that booster you need. And the sixth thing, which I call it reject and replace. Okay. So reject and replace basically means that you get rid of the bad habits, which you did by going to the gym. You get rid of the bad habits and then you replace it with the good habits. Okay. Now, before you can do that, you need to, I didn't mention that in the fourth part, there needs to be some digging. Why am I doing this? Okay. You can't just cover it on and move on. There might be some trauma from your childhood. There must be something in you that's causing you continually to go back to these things. Okay. When I had a session with my coach, he dug really deep into my psyche, you know, and you realize that there were some things that happened to me in my childhood. You know, I got bullied in school, which we all do as Africans. You know, there was a deep inferiority complex when I came to this country. All those things were still there. And that led to the self-sabotaging behavior, you know. So if you go through these six things that I've written in the book, that should help you with the white flag pain. All the pains, actually, because the green flag pain, you just need to believe in yourself. If you've got somebody in your corner, if you've got accountability partners, they'll continually speak good things into your life. They'll encourage you. So the voices that you're hearing from other people will not matter. Do you understand? So these six steps are steps that everyone needs to go through and master. If you do these things continually, you are very unlikely to fall back into the pains that you. But for me, the key thing for me was acceptance. That took me a long time to accept that I had an issue with epilepsy. I had an issue with pornography. It took me a long time. And of course, I didn't accept it. I didn't put in place things. Now I know with epilepsy, if I get stressed, if I don't go to bed early, if I don't eat the right foods, it will come back. So I need to do that. Do you understand? So that's how it is for me. Now, I'm not sure that answers your question.
It definitely does, Stephen. I think one reason why I'm really loving this conversation right now is how practical it is. And we are diving into your very personal experiences, but then we're coming out of each story and out of each answer that you're giving us with very practical tools that we can apply. That's sort of something that we get everywhere as entrepreneurs. You know, we listen to YouTube channels, TED Talks, we get motivational speakers in school. Not all of them leaves us with something that we can test out, that we can play around with, that we can hold and feel it to be real. Sean spoke about something that we had touched on in Founders Friday episode 26, right, where he shared that stage of his life. And the episode was titled Peeling Back the Masks That Men Live Behind. The very fact that, you know, we're here on this podcast, three gentlemen, being this vulnerable and speaking about very real and human experiences, and I hope that's something that our audience can appreciate, and not just appreciate, but also cultivate amongst their circles and amongst the different spaces and conversations that they have. What Sean spoke about and a lot of what you've touched on, Steve, are different. You mentioned the honeymoon period. You know, there's different stages that we go through in life. And as I sit here, I'm looking at Sean a year ago being in the same position I'm in now, right? Writing his dissertation, his final year. And I'm being led by some of the decisions that he made. I'm being led by some of the decisions that you made, Stephen. And I'm very curious to find out, how would you describe the season or stage of life that you're in now? And how does this correlate to the four legacy types that you've touched on in your book? Purist, philanthropist, profligate, and pathfinder. Yeah.
We talk about the formative phase, but the formative phase is not something you just go through and come at the end, okay? So you are continually being formed, okay? You are continually being formed. But for me, the phase come as a point of emphasis, okay? So when you're in the honeymoon period, you are emphasizing on your being, who you are, your purpose, your passion, and making sure those things are in place. In your formative years, you're emphasizing on dealing with the pain. There are two other ones, the partner and the payoff, which we haven't talked about yet. But those ones are your formative phase, because that's when you are forming. Because I talk about the how to choose the right partner using the periodic table, you know. So you choose the right path, how to get the right partner. The payoff, you know, as an entrepreneur, there's always a payoff. You know, how do you deal with the payoff? Those things are your formative. You will always deal with those things in life, okay? But the issue is the emphasis on it. Okay, so when you get into the legacy phase, we are succeeding. It doesn't mean that your honeymoon period is gone. It doesn't mean that your formative period is gone. It does mean that your emphasis now is not on those things anymore. Your emphasis now is on living a legacy. Your emphasis now is on running a good company, being good to your employees, and all that stuff. But you cannot just shift away. They also say, well, I've finished with the pain, so that's it. No, the pain can always come back. And we've seen this. Harvey Weinstein and all these guys, you know, who go back into the formative phase and go back into pain. Because they haven't really put in this place and they're not consistently dealing with it. Okay. So it's not from I go from here to there and then there from there to there. No, it means that your emphasis is no longer on those things anymore. My emphasis now is not so much on pornography anymore, because I've put in things in place to do that. My emphasis now is not so much on white flag pain or dealing with epilepsy. I've dealt with it and I've been able to come around it, and I'm living with it now. My emphasis is not so much on green flag pain now, because now I know that I am an entrepreneur. I know who I am. So if people come and tell me that, oh, Steve, you're a failure, I'm not a failure. So my emphasis is not there anymore. You understand? Yeah. So it comes to a point where in your life, and there are stages in your life where it's more of your thinking, your emphasis, where you are in life. You know, so, and actually my second book, Chasing Permanence, which you mentioned, is more about that. You know, it's about staying permanent where you are. You are staying there and being permanent and not reversing back, you know, and going downhill again. So that's, I don't know whether that answers your question.
So what are you up to now? What does Steven's next decade two look like?
So I said to you before that I'm actually branching out of healthcare now. So my major focus now, legacy phase. My major focus now is mentoring and talking to people, and because it is not acceptable, Sean, that 90% of entrepreneurs are failing. It's not acceptable. I don't think that's good, you know, especially in Africa, you know, because we know we wait for the government to solve our problems. But actually, the most innovative solutions in Africa have come from entrepreneurs, people like you who have brilliant ideas on how to move the continent forward. But we in Africa tend to wait for the government. We tend to wait for a new president, but we know that these things never really bring success. Success comes from entrepreneurs thinking about a problem and how to solve it, you know. And it's not acceptable that so many entrepreneurs are failing. So this stage of my life, I want to invest my life and myself into helping entrepreneurs to go past their fears, to go past their pain, and begin to get more entrepreneurs to get to the legacy phase where they can actually make a tangible difference in people's lives. You know, so before I used to think of making money, which is still there. Obviously, you want to make money, you want to still be rich. That's still there. But the emphasis for me now is that it's leaving a good legacy for people, making sure that Africa succeeds through entrepreneurship and through private enterprise. Not just Africa, even in the UK, across the world. Because it's similar in the UK. It's about an 80% failure rate in the UK. It's the same. People start a business and they fail. And I feel that most of the problems in the world is solved by entrepreneurship and not by governments. That's my personal level.
Yeah, no, for sure. When we look at places like the United States, etc.
Yeah.
When you think of the founding fathers, quote unquote, you know, you might be tempted to think of the George Washingtons, etc. Yeah. But, you know, you need to look at the Rockefellers, the Morgan Stanleys, etc., who really set the quite literal rails and infrastructure that is actually needed to set things up. So I really look forward to a time when, you know, we can sit back and say, you know, the Stevens, the Bonifaces, etc., who have put in place the core infrastructure that can allow for our kids and their kids to live a life where we're not looking over our shoulder. I think many Africans, we're looking over our shoulders, and our governments have failed us. So hey, I think anyone who's listening to this must just understand that lots of things around us as Africans have failed us, but we can't fail ourselves. Like, fundamentally, if there's that one thing that's in our control, I'm leaving here really, really inspired not to fail myself. So Stephen, we are reaching the tail end of our conversation here, and we have a really fun segment that we like to do at the end called the elevator segment. So picture this, right? We've just had this conversation, you know, in our nice looking boardroom, etc. We've learned a lot. We've signed a couple of deals here, there, you know, we've got your book distributed across Africa, you know, all those nice little things. And now you're walking towards the elevator. Our intern quickly stops you, hops into the elevator with you, and, you know, was so inspired by your story, wants to ask you a couple of quick fire questions, but you need to hop onto your bicycle and get to the next place. So are you ready to step into the elevator and answer a couple of quick fire questions?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
I'm a bit anxious, so let's do it.
Yeah. Don't be. Right. So the first question is, what's if you could only have one thing that you're known for? So you're on your deathbed, surrounded by all your loved ones, you're about to leave, go and be with the Lord. You have only one thing that you want to be remembered for, and to know that I did this extremely well. What's that one thing?
It to be that I helped entrepreneurs face their fears and grow through them. Mm. So that is my purpose, to help entrepreneurs face their fears and grow through them.
Yeah.
apart from obviously the stuff of being a good dad and all the stuff that people talk about, being a good dad and being a good father, good husband. That's primary. Awesome. There's one thing I want to remain for that people saw, when Stephen was on earth, he helped me face my fear and he helped me to grow through my fears. That's what I'd like to remember.
Question number two. What's the best thing about success?
Legacy. I think the best thing about success is being able to do these things, you know, to sit down with people and impart knowledge, impart wisdom, impart. I think success puts you in a position of privilege where people listen to you. You know, people listen to Elon Musk, people listen to Obama.
True.
So success gives you that platform where people can listen to you. And for me, success is that, you know, a musician is successful when people listen to his music, you know, an author is successful when people read his books. Of course, he makes money out of the books. Musicians make money, but success, I mean, Elton John, which is one of the superstars in the UK, and recently gave out his last concerts, you know, and there were over 1 million people, close to 1 million people watching his concerts. That's success. People listen to his music. So for me, success means that people have read my book and they've taken actions. They've listened to me talk. They've taken action which has bettered their lives. So that's what my success means to me as a person.
That's super. I'm going to wrap up with my last two questions. You had two interns in here, not one.
Oh, wait.
The first question, Stephen, if you could change one way, if you could change one thing about how you were raised, what would it be?
If I could change one thing about how I was raised, what would it be? I think if I'm honest, my mom was very critical about of my life, and that gave me a bit of self-doubt. And that amplified my green flag pain when I became an entrepreneur. So the only one thing I would change, I mean, my mom is lovely now. She's much, much better. I think because I was the first child. So usually, you know, it's like with Africa, the firstborn, you know. So she was very critical of me when I was little. And that sunk into me, the sense of that I'm not good enough, that I had always had this inferiority complex. And that fed into my green flag pain when I became an entrepreneur. Because when people said things to me, it reminded me of what my mom used to say. You know, you're a failure. You're not going to do well. People are going to trample over you, blah, 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 blah. So that's the only thing that I'll say. But then without that, you have this book. See, so these things have a way of swinging around and God uses them in your favor to really actually make you a better person. So
yeah,
the only thing, but then without that thing, I'll not be here where I am now. So
cheers.
If you listen to this, I love you, mom. And this is not criticism.
Cheers, Stephen's mom. Next question. What's something that you cared about in your 20s that you don't care about anymore today?
Something I care about my 20s that I don't care about anymore today. I think it's the ambition to be fabulously rich, you know, to be able to be and make a lot of money. I still want to make a lot of money, but it's not a priority for me now. You know, I'm okay. I can't buy a Jets or buy a Rolls Royce or do things like that. But I'm fairly okay. And I'm happy with that. You know, but when I was in my 20s, and especially when I finished school and university, I had this big thing, wanted to be really, 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 really rich. And the second thing is I don't care so much about what people say anymore. Before, I used to be really, really sensitive. I'm still sensitive. It's my nature to be sensitive. That's who I am.
Yeah.
I don't care about what people say so much now. Apart from the people that I really, really respect, my accountability partners, which I mentioned to you, which I'm meeting in about an hour from now. And obviously my wife and my kids and a few other people, I listen to what they say and I take it seriously. But people, or somebody from the streets or what somebody says about me, I don't, people have said really, really horrible things about the book I've written. I really do not care. You've mastered the green flag. Yeah. And that comes from the
sense of,
oh gosh, you even know these things more than I do now.
We're your students. You know, we usually talk about how.
Yeah, so that's what I'll say.
Yeah.
They care about people and what people think about me doesn't.
And now you talk about
a major weakness, really, a major weakness.
Yeah. We usually talk about how this podcast is a masterclass. It's a university course.
Absolutely.
After we hit our 10-year average period as entrepreneurs, we flip this podcast into a university.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, you guys have done really well. I've listened to some of your podcasts, and I've been struck, like I said to Sean, about your professionalism, your humility, the way you guys seem to be eager to learn. You're a model for Africa, and I just hope that our leaders would learn from people like you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I mean, that's deeply humbling coming from you. And the reason why we like to have these conversations is perspective, because perspective is something that's learned. But also in our increasingly modernized world, I mean, Boniface and I, we live in the city. I moved out from home, you know, staying by myself, not with my parents, grandparents. So sometimes, you know, in our capitalist modernized society, a lot of young people are getting further and further away from critical advice, mentorship, and grooming that, you know, otherwise in our more traditional settings would have come more naturally, right? So, you know, when we're able to sit down here with an individual like you who's gone down a road that we're so eager to go down, we now have that foresight from you that now we also impart on our audience. So, you know, this podcast, I mean, we didn't start it because we had ideas of grandeur or, you know, we wanted this or that. It was really like, hey, we're in our final years of university. We have so much to learn. How can we learn from others while learning as we build something? So, Stephen, this has been an absolute joy and pleasure. And I think one of the things that two things people should leave with. One is that pain should never get in the way of gain, right? So, I mean, pain is it's a part of life. And, you know, one of the Bible verses that really encouraged me during my tough time is when, you know, Jesus said that in this life you will have troubles, but take heart, for I have overcome. You know, this is a guy who had gone through the most. I mean, we think we've suffered, but you know, he's just encouraging people like, guys, you'll go through the most. You know, like, we are never actually guaranteed anywhere, nowhere. You know, I'm very skeptical of people who have ideologies that are all about like, oh, butterflies and sunshine, oh wow, life is crazy out here, it's wild. And so, you know, whoever's listening to this, please just take note that things get better, but you need to understand what you're going through. Put words to it, source the roots of some of your behaviors that might be as a result of pain. You know, look at your childhood, look at some of the traumas, etc., that have happened, because we do things today because things happened to us in the past. Like, we're just reflections of what's happening around us and how we internalize it. So take heart, everyone. There's ways to go through these things. We'd really highly recommend going through Stephen's book, Pay the Price. We will be giving details as to how to go about that. But Stephen, you also have a really awesome blog that you write on LinkedIn. So if everyone goes out and checks out Stephen Adjei out on LinkedIn, man, your blog it's fantastic. So a lot of the themes that, you know, you've spoken about in the book, the blog is like really a great space to, you know, where you're speaking about these things a lot more practically, a lot more frequently. So if for any reason you can't get the book, at the least you could do is follow Stephen Adjei on LinkedIn. I love that blog. And Boniface just read your latest one. I also read it.
Thank you so much. That's very humbling.
So yeah, I mean, we've appreciated this. And oh yeah, the second thing that I think I'm leaving here with, and I think has been as a result of just your deep experience, and getting out of it required you to have frameworks and mental models, right? If there's one thing that I've really taken away from the way you approach things from our initial conversation to now here in the boardroom, is that problems need to be dealt with frameworks, right? There's a really interesting quote that says, problems cannot be solved from the psychology or mindset that created them in the first place.
The level of predictability, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so what I'm really seeing from you is that you wrote a whole book. Yani, like you sat down and said, I've gone through the most, I got out of it, but there was practical steps. And I really encourage anyone who's listening to this to encourage themselves to be structured thinkers, right? Approach things in frameworks, right? Something is wrong. Why is it wrong? Ask yourself good questions. Get to the root of things, right? Because when we act out of our emotions and out of pain, we only hurt ourselves. Absolutely. Anyway, that was just what was in my head right now. Just had to just brain dump that as what I'm taking away from this. Stephen, this has been an amazing, amazing episode. I hope you've enjoyed your time in the boardroom.
Yeah, I've loved it. You guys are quite nice to talk to. I've loved it. And one thing I'd like to add as well is journaling. Okay, so most of my books have come through my journals.
Boniface, are you hearing? Your book needs to...
I'm sleeping on myself. Well,
actually, this second book of mine is there. Yeah, so journals are incredibly important because thoughts are entangled in your mind, isn't it? So when you take out a thought and you put it on paper, it becomes a separateness. Wow. And then it can go on it. You know, by the thoughts in your mind, and you don't write them down, then they continually just go on your mind, you know? And if I'm in a quiet space in the morning, I get most of my blocks in the morning when I'm in a quiet space and I got my pen out of my paper, I use it, begins to flow, you know? And you can look at it separately from you as a person, you understand? It turns out to be a life of its own. You know, if it's in your mind, you don't deal with it, it's going to be just run around your mind. Yeah.
I have like four half-empty, like half-full journals. You're really calling me out here, Stephen.
We all have pending books.
I tell you. Yeah, journals are crucial, especially in writing them, okay? You're not typing. Actually, writing them with a pen and paper. It's crucial. So, yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much once again for your time, Stephen. Thank you so much for our listeners. For listening till if you reach this point, you need to one way to get into our boardroom community, man. And on that note, you know, we are still getting a lot more people into the boardroom. We don't just want you to listen to Stephen, we want you to also have a chance of meeting him. You know, when we do come around to putting together some of our virtual meetups, we want you right there so you can ask Stephen whatever questions that you've been writing down in your notebook as you've been listening. If you've been driving on your way to work as you're listening to this, if you've been working out, if you've been cycling, you know, we'd love for you to bring your questions and bring your own experiences as well into the boardroom and let us know how you personalized this specific conversation with Stephen and the fantastic story that he has. On that note, my name is Boniface Mina. I was your host. I was joined by Sean Karanja. And Stephen, would you like to sign us off as well?
Thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure. And I love you all, guys.
Cheers. See you guys on the next episode.